I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Women of all ages have been devouring and discussing 50 Shades of Grey, the first of a trilogy of erotic novels written by British author E.L. James. The story is about the dominant submissive relationship between a handsome billionaire named Christian Grey and a virginal college graduate named Anastasia Steele. This contemporary take on the bodice ripper is not new in the world of fiction, but this book has generated a fair amount of reaction, mostly because of its popularity among women readers. Today in Radio Times, what is all this fuss about? What do these books say about women's fantasy lives? And what about dominance and submission in the real world? This is an adult conversation not suitable for children. Let me introduce our two guests, both of whom join us by telephone. Tracy Clark Flory is a staff writer at Salon, where she writes about sex and relationships. Her work has appeared in the Best Sex Writing Anthology. And Tracy Clark Flory, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Debbie Herbenik is also with us. She's a research scientist, co-director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion, and a sexual health educator at the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction, and that's at Indiana University. She's the author of several books, including most recently Sex Made Easy. And Debbie Herbenik, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And Debbie, let me begin with you. This is a story about a dominant, submissive relationship. Why do you think it's found such an enthusiastic female audience?
Oh, it's a good question. You know, I think this book has certainly exposed a lot of women to the genre of erotic fiction, and it takes us out of our daily lives a little bit. I think it's a very intense and salient story of desire, first and foremost, regardless of what they're actually doing with their sexual behaviors. I think it's about desire and wanting.
And how about for you, Tracy? Why do you think this has become such a popular book, especially among women?
Well, I think it's popular for the same fundamental reason that Twilight is so popular. As you mentioned, it's a modern remake of the classic Beauty and the Beast tale. In both cases, you have a sensitive bad boy, a monster in need of saving from his own dark desires. You know, only in the case of Shades of Grey, our hero has riding crops instead of fangs. I think that BDSM acts as an edgy update on this standard romantic trope.
Debbie, if I can go back to you, are you bothered at all that it's not particularly well written? And I forget how many times Anastasia says, "Holy cow." You don't often find that, I don't think, in erotic literature.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly tend to read a different type of literature, so I wouldn't say that this was my favorite reading. And it does bother me a little bit, but enough to take me out of the story and away from trying to understand what women like about it, no. And, you know, I've talked with so many women and some book clubs who have been reading this book, and although everyone notes that the writing is not particularly good and even grates on them at times, most women seem to be sticking with the story and wanting to turn the pages to get to more sex scenes.
And I do want to get to that, but Tracy, did this book in any way shock you? Were you shocked by anything you read in this?
No, the only thing that was shocking to me was that I read it after hearing all of the hype, and I was kind of shocked by how tame it was, actually, and how slow-moving it was. I actually was expecting a bit more edginess.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the slow-moving, and I wonder whether that was, you know, 200 pages of foreplay or not.
Yeah.
There is what seems like pages and pages and pages and pages of negotiations between these two people over this relationship.
Yes, and endless email exchanges back and forth.
That was painful.
Yes.
Painful to read, just because why?
It was. I also kept thinking, because I had heard it hyped so much, and so by the time I read it, I thought, well, you know, where is this going? When are they ever actually going to get together? And I did wonder, you know, how much of this is sort of intentional foreplay and the delaying of the gratification for the reader as well, and how much is it just the fact that, you know, this was originally written in ways that, you know, were supposed to kind of lure people in and online and keep them engaged in this long series.
Let me go back to you, Tracy, and I do want to talk about the characters of Christian Grey, the man in this story. He's 20-something. He's not a millionaire. He's a billionaire. Very handsome, very sexy, of course. What do you make of this particular character? As you say, this is a kind of a remake of a story that's been around for some time.
Exactly. He's her knight in shining armor. He rode up on his horse and swept her off her feet. But of course, you know, for a good story, you have to have some conflict. And so the whole, I mean, really most of the sexual tension and excitement of the book, I think, centers around their very antagonistic relationship outside of the bedroom. And that sort of power play, which is one that you see in most romantic novels, most bodice rippers. He's that classic romantic hero, you know, a modern billionaire version of that.
Debbie, your thoughts about this character?
Oh, yeah, Tracy's spot on in that regard. And when I've been at book clubs with women talking about 50 Shades of Grey, the fact that he is just this attractive billionaire, as you said, not just, you know, moderately wealthy, but as one woman said the other night, I mean, he makes $100,000 an hour, you know, and this is, you know, he's sort of like the ultimate catch to some women. And, you know, that it elevates him to this bigger status, particularly for a woman who feels insecure and who feels unattractive and who wonders if she has that value. So I think that same element, though, is what a lot of women find problematic with the book, is because there is this sense of her putting up with a lot that probably, you know, most women think women shouldn't be putting up with.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but let me ask you, I'll go back to you, Tracy, about then Anastasia Steele as a character. She's about to graduate or is graduating from college. She's a virgin. What do you make of her as a character in these kinds of stories?
Well, she's really interesting because she's such a reluctant submissive. It's not really a desire that she seems to want to pursue. Her real desire is him, and because he has these desires, she's willing to sort of entertain them, and she does sort of express that she's intrigued by this world of his, but she's also disgusted by it and revolted by his desires, and so I think that really there that tension between the two of them, that it taps into that classic storyline of a woman trying to save or change a man.
I mean, she is disgusted in some ways, Tracy, but she's also intrigued and in many ways turned on by it too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and I think that, I don't know, I think that taps into a very a shared experience or a very common experience that people have when it comes to their own sexuality, this feeling of, you know, titillation, but also shame about what turns them on. And that tension there, I think, is something that people can very easily relate to.
Debbie, let me go back to you and this notion of the reluctant submissive. How do you understand that?
Well, you know, I think it's I teach college students at Indiana University, so I'm around, you know, many of these young women and men who are making the transition to having sex for the first time. And I think what's so interesting about that time period of life, which, of course, Anastasia is in, is that people often go very quickly in a short span of months or a year or two from thinking that a variety of behaviors are gross or perverted or in some way not what people like them do, to once they become sexually active in whatever way that is for them, and there's so many different ways that people start having sex, to being, as you said, you know, turned on and interested. So, you know, in this case, the person who she met had these interests that we have no reason to believe she had on her own at first, but because she was so drawn to him and so desirous of him, she, you know, I think not just did them to please him, but maybe saw them through his eyes and was willing to try them out and found some of them, not everything, but found some of them to be exciting. And I think that's a common trajectory that you see for young women and men, is this willingness to try things on, and then you learn something new about your sexual self in that way.
Debbie, would it be fair to say that erotic fantasies are not politically correct?
Often they're not. Absolutely.
And going back to you, Tracy, and in reading, both reading the book, but also reading about the book, there is this question about, you know, can you be a feminist and, mm-hmm. and fantasize about submission, which is, you know, in many ways what this book is, looking at this relationship between the dominant and the submissive. Do you have an answer to that question?
Oh, absolutely. You absolutely can be a feminist and fantasize about submission and even degradation, even things that, you know, were you to experience them in real life, in the real world, without consent, would be absolutely not feminist and antithetical to feminism. But I think that, for the most part, I think that young feminists, especially today, have a real respect for the world of fantasy and the world of fantasy standing apart from the real world, and that's sort of it's a safe place to explore unresolved issues that we have about the world that we live in. I think that, you know, inevitably you're going to sort of eroticize power imbalances that you see in the world at large. I don't think that there's anything anti-feminist about that.
Do you think, Tracy, that there are some generational differences and that younger feminists are influenced by popular culture and popular cultures, you know, always exploring things on the edges?
I don't know if it's that younger feminists are influenced by popular culture so much as I think that there is growing awareness of the places that fantasy can take us, and a respect for fantasy and it being okay to explore those things.
Deb, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, you know, I think young feminists also, you know, the types of media that they have exposure to, there's so many great feminist blogs out there, and they do tend to be, you know, sort of narrow in focus, but that gives young women a real place to go talk and to have these conversations and learn what other women like them feel. And I think one of the topics that I see that's a common thread is really what it means to be a feminist in regard to your sexuality, mm-hmm. and to be able to make the kinds of choices to engage in, you know, whatever variety of behaviors you want to engage in, even if they might be behaviors that, you know, shift the power imbalance in ways that to others might not seem like they're in your favor, but if you're choosing them, they're in your favor.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Also want to open up the lines, and we know that many people, including many women, have been reading 50 Shades of Grey. It's the first in a trilogy of erotic novels by the British author E.L. James. We are talking about this phenomenon, talking with Debbie Herbenick. She's a research scientist, co-director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion, and a sexual health educator at the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction, and that's at Indiana University. She's written a number of books, including most recently Sex Made Easy. Also with us is Tracy Clark Flory, staff writer at Salon. She writes about sex and relationships, and her work has been featured in the Best Sex Writing Anthology. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network. They offer access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach to care, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, an evening of dance with Brenda Dixon Gottschild, Joan Myers Brown, and Philadanko. The evening begins with a conversation between Gottschild and Brown, moderated by Councilwoman Blondell Reynolds Brown. Following the discussion, Philadanko will perform excerpts from their repertory, beginning at 5:45. More details are available at philamuseum.org.
Bring your appetite, food fanatics, as WHYY celebrates some of the region's greatest culinary minds with Best of the Chefs, a two-hour tasting featuring an array of area restaurants, breweries, and businesses. They'll serve up their tastiest treats, and your votes decide who is crowned Best of the Chefs in several mouth-watering categories. Also, a raffle, beer garden, and live music, Thursday, June 21st. Tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Debbie Herbenick and Tracy Clark Flory about 50 Shades of Grey, 50 Shades of Grey, that's G-R-E-Y, and it's the surprise hit book this year. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Tracy, let me go back to you and actually quote the author, who is a former BBC production executive. And this is what she said about the book and why she thinks it has caught on and become so popular. She said, it's a combination of things. Fundamentally, people love a good love story. They like the sex as well. They love Christian Grey, a complicated, damaged, talented man. He's very capable and strong and domineering, but broken. So he's a fixer-upper. I mean, it's a fantasy, the whole book. And so they bought into it and suspended their disbelief, gone on vacation, really. Makes sense to you, Tracy?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, clearly the woman knew what she was doing. She summarized the appeal right there in a nutshell. If he had been this perfect romantic hero who was perfectly available to her in every way that she wanted, there wouldn't be much of a story there. We need that tension. We need her, to see her working towards reforming him, towards turning him into the man that she wants him to be. Where those stories are incredibly compelling.
Mm. It's been called by some mommy porn. Do you like that, Tracy? Do you like that description?
No, because I actually don't think that it's accurate. I can't remember the exact statistics, but I do remember seeing a report on the actual readership of the book, and it wasn't actually mostly moms. There's a broad readership, and I think many young women are reading the book. So I don't think that's accurate. I think that label really reflects more about the way that we as a society look at women's sexuality and sort of diminish it than it does really tell us anything about the book itself.
What do you think about that, Debbie?
Oh, I completely agree. I think, I get that people are always looking for kind of a short, snazzy word or phrase to describe something, and mommy porn has become that. But I agree with Tracy that there's a real diversity of women and men who are picking up 50 Shades of Grey and finding something of interest in it.
Let me go back to you, Debbie. Help us understand how this relationship works between, the dominant and the submissive. This is the kind of heart of the book as these two sort of negotiate this relationship. But even in the real world, what is this about?
So in the real world, when there are dominant and submissive relationships, and there are differences between people who disengage in sexual behaviors with each other versus having a real, ongoing, dominant-submissive type of relationship. But what often happens is that people will make a contract with each other, as you see in the book, and you describe very clearly what's okay with you and what's not okay with you, because once you're actually in what you would call the scene, so you're actually sort of, acting something out and participating in the types of behaviors together, part of the play is that you might say things like no, no, or you might cry out in pain, and that's acting, right? And like you're saying that, and so you don't want someone to misinterpret that as stop, because you actually want that to happen. Mm-hmm. So in contracts, not only do you spell out the behaviors that you are and are not okay with, sexually and otherwise, but also the types of language or safe words that you might use to stop something that you don't want to do. So underlying all of these types of BDSM behaviors is what people often say the mantra is: safe, sane, and consensual.
Well, let me quote something actually that Maureen Dowd quoted. She interviewed a woman who's, a dominant, but the quote is here, and I'll put this back to you, Debbie. Every good dominant knows that the submissive is really the partner in control, which on the face of it, doesn't look that way. But does that make sense to you?
It does. It's absolutely the case. And because if you really are doing this in a way that involves open communication and respect and done the way that, you know, we would all say it sort of should be done, then yes, the submissive is in control because they are describing what their boundaries are. Does that always work out that way in real life? No. You know, there are certainly some situations that go wrong. But when done well and when done in this consensual way, that is the case.
Do you see that? I'm curious how you see this relationship, Tracy.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that when BDSM is done correctly, when it is practiced safely, sanely, and consensually, that the submissive really is the one in control, because the submissive is the one who's setting all of the boundaries. You know, I've written before about how this doesn't actually always play out that way. There are some issues in the BDSM community, I think, with safe words not being respected or ignored, and which is inevitable that you're going to find people who are not respectful of the rules. But for the most part, that is how it actually plays out.
That it's a drama that two people, in a sense, sign up to play together.
Exactly. It's play acting. It's fun. It's role play.
In this novel, Debbie, there's this Christian Grey has this quote unquote red room of pain. It's full of all sorts of equipment. Why is pain part of this back and forth relationship? What's the role of pain?
What do you mean by that?
Well, what, and I know even in the book and doing a little research myself, is this sort of notion between pleasure and pain. And I think for a lot of people, you know, pain is over here, pleasure is over there, and the thought that they somehow could be connected doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, I think that is a difficult thing for a lot of people to wrap their minds around, because for most people, pain does not cause or contribute to pleasure and can detract from pleasure and sex. For some people, the physical pain, for reasons we don't fully understand, does cause pleasure. There have been plenty of women in research studies I've done and men who have talked about having their orgasms triggered by experiencing some type of either extreme discomfort or even pain. But for a lot of other people, it's the psychological aspects. And so many of the BDSM behaviors actually don't even cause a lot of physical pain. So there are many different, for example, gradations of whips or floggers or different types of, you know, paddles that some actually wouldn't cause, you know, most people any pain at all. But in the play element, in the drama, you know, there is the psychological aspect of sort of inflicting or receiving pain. So there are different things, and there are different types of people who are responding to each.
And how much is control an issue?
Well, control is is the main feature, right? So another phrase for this type of experience is power play. And so it's the idea of, you know, exchanging different levels of power and somebody taking or giving, over some control. And that's exciting for many people.
And that's Debbie Herbenick, and she joins us along with Tracy Clark Flory. We are talking about the phenomenon of the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy that many women and some men are reading as well. We're talking about what this relationship between this college graduate and a billionaire, what this relationship is about, talking about fantasy and also real-life BDSM relationships. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And if you haven't figured this out already, this is an adult conversation, not appropriate for children. Let me get Dee from Turnersville, New Jersey, to join our conversation. And Dee, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm the owner of actually two women-oriented adult novelty boutiques in Turnersville and Marlton, New Jersey, and I just have to say we've never seen anything like this phenomenon before. Our sales are up significantly over the past month since this book has come out. Not only are we completely selling out of the book, but we're also selling out of the items that are mentioned in the book. And we have women who we've never seen in our stores before who've been way too shy to come in the past, and they are buying things in great number and giving it to all of their girlfriends as well.
Well, that's fascinating. Let me give Tracy Clark Flory, a chance to weigh in on that. Does it surprise you, Tracy?
No, it doesn't actually. I've noticed that some adult boutiques are promoting certain toys alongside the book. They clearly have seen an opportunity to to promote mm-hmm. alongside it. So that's not surprising at all.
You've had this book, sir, for a number of years?
Yes, for over 30 years.
For over 30 years. And this is unusual, what's been happening in the last month?
It's absolutely unusual. You know, sometimes when a certain product is mentioned on, say, The View or Dr. Oz, we'll notice a slight uptick, but we've never seen anything this significant and this long-lasting. People continue to come in on a daily basis, and it's not only women, but men are coming in saying, my wife is reading this book. Can you tell me what's in this book that I can buy for her? And men are also reading the book just to see what all the fuss is with that their wives are reading. It's really unprecedented in the industry. We are, like I said, the entire industry right now is selling out of products that literally have been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years in some cases. And all of a sudden, women are rediscovering it, and we cannot keep these products in stock.
That's fascinating. Debbie, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, you know, I've been wondering actually how the actual sales have been going, because like Tracy, I've noticed certainly that there are definite changes in marketing, right? A lot of the websites that I'm familiar with, I've noticed now have 50 Shades of Grey sections. And, you know, if indeed there is an increase in sales, to me, that, you know, that reminds me of what happened with the Rabbit Vibrator. You know, when that went on Sex and the City in 1998, it changed vibrator sales at that time, but interestingly enough, it also changed the vibrator sales for years to come. So many people that I know that own sex toy websites and so sell them online or will often say that still to this day, one of the most common search terms that brings people to their site or that people look for once they're on their site are terms related to the Rabbit Vibrator.
Let me get, Dee, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what Margaret from Brooklyn has to say. Margaret, go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, hello, I'm
Hi.
On the air.
You are on the air, Margaret. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm in my 80s, and I read this book with the thought that it was a love story, and that's how I looked at it, not as pornography or mommy porn or whatever you're calling it. I read it as a true love story. When you're deeply in love with someone, and she was in love with him, and she changed him, and he had a very bad background. His background was horrendous. And pain was part of his background as a child. And I looked at it that this young girl changed this man, but loved him dearly, and he loved her.
Margaret,
and that's how I looked at that book.
Well, hold on one second. Let me give our guests a chance to respond. And Tracy, I'll go back to you first.
Yeah, I think that absolutely that is a large part of the appeal. And I think that that's a lot of what readers want to see is they want to see him change. They want to see her save him, essentially, from himself.
From himself. And the idea of a woman, in a sense, taming a man, is that
exactly.
What, is that what we're
yeah,
talking about?
Yeah, exactly. It gets right back again to that Beauty and the Beast tale. It's a classic.
And Margaret, I'm curious, are other friends of yours reading this book?
Yes, they are. And since I have the three of them, they want me to pass the book on to them. So that's what we're doing. And we're thoroughly enjoying it and having a lot of fun with it, dear.
Well, good for you. And I appreciate.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
And okay, dear.
Thanks. You take care. Debbie, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Oh, I just want to go to lunch with Margaret and talk about this. It's a fascinating thing. I think, you know, like Tracy was saying, that there is this common tale that we, you know, that we see over and over and over again, where women are trying to save or change a man. And I think what's interesting and what's not well understood at all is why that's such an erotic story for women, right? It's not just a story that we think is nice or sweet, but there's something compelling and ultimately erotic about the Beauty and the Beast story, Red Riding Hood. I mean, all of these things draw women to that. And I think that remains a bit of a mystery to us all.
Well, and I'm wondering, just picking up on that, Debbie, among people in the BDSM community, would they like that, you know, how this story concludes, the idea that she sort of tames him and takes him away from the kind of sex that he enjoys to the more vanilla sex that she likes?
That's an interesting question. I guess I would say that you know, there's certainly a lot of diversity within the BDSM community, right? And not everybody does stay in it forever. I think if there's one common thread that I see among a lot of people in the community, it would be that, you know, there's an acceptance for what you decide is right for you, and that there are different types of sex that are right for you at different times. So it doesn't mean that BDSM is bad and in order to have a fulfilling sex life you need to give it up. But I would say that, you know, there is a transformative power of relationships, and ultimately couples have to find what's right for them together.
Mm-hmm. Tracy, did you want to add to that?
Oh, no, I completely agree. I think that it's really important to emphasize the range in the community, and that there are people who see it as a permanent fundamental part of their sexuality, and there are others who flirt with it for a while and move on to something else. So it isn't any one thing.
And do you, Tracy? You live in the world of books in many ways, but can we then anticipate sort of knockoffs of 50 Shades of Grey, since it's obviously found such an enthusiastic audience?
I'm shocked that we haven't already seen them.
Really?
Yeah, any minute now, really. And I mean, I think the interesting thing is that it must have been maybe 2 years ago that I wrote a piece about kink in general becoming mainstream, and that was just inspired by these songs and music videos by mainstream pop stars like Rihanna and Christina Aguilera. That were flirting with the idea of BDSM, or at least, you know, mildly kinky sex, and so I think all of this was very predictable. At the same time, it's obviously very hard to sort of capitalize on this trend, and this book does it beautifully.
Mm. Debbie, going back to you, that since you work at the Kinsey Institute and in many ways probably know what really goes on in people's bedrooms, but has sex gotten more kinky, to use Tracy's words?
You know, I think we certainly talk more openly about sort of kink aspects of sex, but one of the great things about the Kinsey Institute is that we're not just a place where research happens, but we have an incredible art and library collection. And so there are images from so many different historical time periods, you know, photographs when photographs became available, but before that, drawings and paintings. And, you know, there are elements of what we now call BDSM throughout history and in many different, you know, cultures. And so, you know, certainly these interests have always existed. They've taken different shape at different times in different places, but it's not new.
Right.
It's just more often talked about.
But I wonder whether the internet, because of it, how pervasive it is and how much access people have to it, whether that has, in a sense, upped the ante, Debbie.
You know, we get asked that a lot, and I think, you know, it's tough because the internet, the way it happened so quickly, especially in the United States. And so it's tough to just sort of look back and say what caused what. I think there's no doubt that, a couple callers ago, that one woman who had the adult bookstores talked about, an increase in interest in sort of BDSM types of sex toys. So that happens, and I think that the internet certainly exposes people to a lot of products and ideas and sexual practices, and many people sort of flirt with them or try them out. But I think the bigger question would then be, to what extent do they even sustain them? There are many things that people try out and see as adding sort of spice to their sexual lives, as people often say. But there are fewer things that become sort of a long-term part of people's sexual lives.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Debbie Herbenick and Tracy Clark Flory about the phenomenon of 50 Shades of Grey, the trilogy of erotic novels by British author E.L. James. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We're interested if you are reading this book, what you make of it, and if you're not reading it, why not? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. At Fox Chase, molecular medicine helps improve diagnostics for cancer patients. Using the genetic analysis of tumor cells, doctors readily identify the best use of existing cancer drugs and design more effective clinical trials. As DNA sequencing becomes more prevalent in cancer care, Fox Chase is committed to discovering how these methods can best help patients and lead to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Eitan Pate story has opened old wounds and also raised hope for the friends and family of other children who've gone missing. We'll meet a woman who's been looking for her childhood friend for 36 years. Also, how's it going for David Halberg, the dancer who became the first American to sign on with the Bolshoi? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show supports WHYY and circles the square in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square at 18th and Walnut, Friday through Sunday, June 1st to 3rd. Open Friday and Saturday at 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Featuring original artwork from over 140 locally and nationally recognized artists. A variety of paintings, prints, drawings, and sculptures will be exhibited. The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show, RittenhouseSquareArt.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about 50 Shades of Grey with Debbie Herbenick. She's a research scientist, co-director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion, also a sexual health educator at the Kinsey Institute. She's written several books, including Sex Made Easy. Also with us, Tracy Clark Flory, a staff writer at Salon. She writes about sex and relationships. And her work, both as a reporter and a personal essayist, has appeared in the yearly Best Sex Writing Anthology. We have a full bank of calls here. Let me get Colin from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. And Colin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering, eroticism aside, that seems to be the focus of the conversation thus far. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the unrealistic expectations, I think, that this book and books like Twilight seem to generate, especially among young women reading this who aren't married, as more than literature, more as a recipe for what they want their life to look like. So they're looking for these bad boy fixer-uppers instead of just a natural compassion and love. They need more than that. They need to fix up some deep flaw or conflict.
Colin, it's a great call. I appreciate calling into Radio Times. And Debbie, maybe I'll put that to you first, and then Tracy, I'd love to hear what you have to say as well.
You know, it's... This is a big area of research, actually, is trying to understand who women desire and who women desire at different points in their menstrual cycle, at different points in life. I don't have an answer for it. I think it's certainly, always good to think about the many different things that shape us and the kind of people that we're interested in. And I think, books and mainstream culture do play some role in that. But I also think it's pretty clear that things like your family experiences play a role in that, your hormones play a role in that, your particular situation in life and how advantaged or disadvantaged you are, for example, in need of money or resources. I mean, there are so many things that shape the type of short-term and long-term partners that women and men are interested in, and I see this as just one sliver of that.
Well, and Tracy, it's hard to be a flawed, handsome billionaire in the real world.
Yeah, right. I guess I think that the important thing here to remember is that that this is fantasy, and it's. I don't think that women are necessarily coming to it, looking at it as a guide to relationships. Certainly, that's true for some women, and certainly. Many women are coming to this story because they obviously have a desire for this sort of broken hero. But I think that, there is some hope just in that people are capable of separating their very unrealistic fantasy life from their real lives.
Well, and certainly men fantasize as much as women, so...
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about 50 Shades of Grey, but we could have a reverse conversation about something else. Colin, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what Fiona from Ambler has to say. And Fiona, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm loving the discussion. I'm partway through the first book. And it struck me as soon as I started reading it that it seems to be this generation's 9.5 weeks or the story of O. There seems to be a pattern where every 10 or 15 years this story... Now, hits is another, shall we say, very hot topic for women to enjoy, and it seems to be this generation's story of 9.5 weeks.
Do you agree with that, Tracy?
I think so, absolutely. That's a great observation.
How about for you, Debbie?
Yeah. Just the other day, I was saying to someone, I thought it was sort of like, you know, the My Secret Garden and Nancy Friday kind of thing. And I do. I think every now and then, you know, a book or a movie pops up, and that becomes the thing.
And Tracy, let me go back to you. It sometimes is tricky to translate from the page to the screen, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what people think about when they're reading a book like this might not fit what they see on the screen. Can you imagine that this would create a certain kind of, if not pornography, a certain kind of graphic love / dominant submissive movie out there?
Right. It'll certainly be interesting to see how they make that happen. I'm curious to see how they negotiate the sex scenes. It'll be. I was actually talking with some friends just last night about you know whether they'll sort of fade to black or whether you know we actually will see some of the action. I think most likely it'll be a combination of the two, some explicitness, but probably there will be a fade to black.
What do you think, Debbie?
Yeah, I would imagine that they'll fade to black for a lot of these things or otherwise somehow sort of allude to them. I just don't see Hollywood being able to pull something off mainstream that accurately reflects what's in the book. I think what'll be really interesting with the movie, too, though, is how people go see it. You know, this book has been such a book that even though some men are reading it, that a lot of women are reading privately, and then they may get together and talk about it with their friends, but they're reading it privately. And then to have this very erotic experience, I wonder how many of them will be groups of girlfriends going versus, you know, women pulling their partner along to go with them.
Fiona, thanks for calling in. Oh, excuse me, Nicole, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's Nicole from Wincote to join us on Radio Times. Too many colors here that I'm looking at on my computer. Nicole, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I was calling to respond to one of your guests' comments when you all compared the book in reference to Beauty and the Beast. And mm-hmm. I think her comment, she wasn't sure what women found so erotic about the taming of the beast or how this character tamed the man in the story. And I haven't read the story, but my thought was, it seems like a combination of desire and power that would seem very attractive and alluring to women to have that kind of power to change and tame a man, and that you would be so desired by him that would happen. Which then is, we're talking about this woman being in a submissive position. Ultimately, if you can accomplish that, it's a huge sense of power that you would feel, I would think.
Well, Nicole, let me give Debbie Herbenick a chance to weigh in on that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think there's a lot of sense of feeling like I have enough power, or I'm, you know, pretty enough or smart enough or interesting enough or erotic enough, sensual enough to change this person. I'm still very interested in the complexities of it. You know, I think that that's a good hint in the direction of probably what is so erotic to women about this story. Mm-hmm. And I guess just the researcher in me wants to know more.
Yeah, fair enough. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Nicole, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Susan from Ballykinwood to join our conversation. And Susan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Marty.
Sure.
I'd like to posit a question for your specialist that you have today.
Sure.
Given the cultural phenomenon of 11 million copies we have to pay attention to, that kind of response to 50 Shades of Grey, it seems that the conversation has been primarily based on the S&M aspect of this, and that's sort of a taboo that's been broken for, I guess, a lot of the readers of this book. However, my question is, if we've exploded this taboo in the fashion that we have and that's been so popular, do you think, or can I get an answer for one of your folks, does anyone feel that other taboos now will be better received? For example, women who are in a relationship outside of their marriage, a long-lasting relationship, and there are plenty of them, but they don't want to go on record.
Right.
Do you think that is going to be better received now that folks are going to be, particularly women, will be more open-minded in terms of their readership?
It's an interesting question that you pose, Susan. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And perhaps, Debbie, I can go back to you. And do you see this as breaking taboos and maybe opening the doors to breaking other taboos?
I think it might. You know, and I do think that I'm not sure if our caller was talking about, you know, cheating versus open relationships. Right. But I do see in the last few years a lot more public conversation about, you know, open relationships. You know, Dan Savage has used the term monogamish to be mostly monogamous, but sometimes, you know, being sexual with other people. So there are different terms that people use. But I do think that that's going to be another taboo that we're going to continue to see broken down. I think there are just so many people that are living their lives and their relationships in some sort of more, you know, interesting, nuanced way rather than just like monogamous or not. And I think we can't help but start to talk about that more and hopefully eventually accept that more.
What do you think, Tracy?
Yeah, I think that increasingly we are recognizing the ways that monogamy can and often does fail. And we're coming up with new and creative ways to address that. And I also think in general that we're becoming much more accepting of non-traditional family formations. And so, you know, the gay marriage has become so much more acceptable. The transformation in that arena has been just spectacular. So I think that in general we're seeing a major transformation in how we, in our openness to, you know, conceiving of different family and romantic formulation.
Do you see this as healthy, Debbie?
I do. I think that anytime we can have cultural conversations around, you know, different ways that people live their romantic lives, their families, their sexual lives, that that's a good thing. And I think, you know, this book is certainly part of it. I think we've been breaking taboos for so many years. Sometimes we forget how far we've come, even from just the fact that, you know, women can wear pants to work and not be sent home. And that has to do with sex, and it has to do with gender. And, you know, every generation has different taboos that they get to see sort of broken down, like the Berlin Wall. And I think, you know, having some conversation about power exchange relationships is just one of them for this current generation.
Tracy, where we could have called out to people that have done parodies of this book, and I think anything that's popular, especially, you know, among the quote-unquote masses, invites parody. Do you see this as a big target for parody as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. My roommate actually just last night showed me an SNL parody of the book where involving, you know, a fake Amazon.com ad for Mother's Day, and it involved a lot of moms in compromising positions with the book. So, you know, I think it's definitely a prime target.
Let me get Kate from Winmore to join our conversation. And Kate, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm a psychologist,
yes.
And I read the book, the first of the trilogy, along with many of my patients who were talking about it in therapy. And my experience was that the book itself was quite disturbing, and it was an experience of being tortured. I took the book with me. Christian Grey showed up in many of my dreams in a very disturbing way. The book is clearly an erotic fairy tale, and it does play on a lot of archetypal images,
right.
But I think that the readers need to be warned that it's not without a dark side, and a very disturbing dark side that touches on many primal issues.
Well, it sounds like it touched a lot of issues for you, Kate, if you were dreaming about this particular character. Let me give...
I'm not the only one who was dreaming.
No,
I
totally...
It's very moving in that way.
I hear you. Let me give Debbie Herbenik a chance to weigh in. Debbie, I'd be curious what you say.
Yeah, so, you know, last night I actually was with a group of five girlfriends, and one of them talked about dreaming of Christian Grey. For her, it was a very positive experience. She said, you know, I kept thinking, who does he look like? And I was, you know, looking online thinking, does he look like this actor or this actor? And I just couldn't ever really put a face with him, and she's, I think, on the second book now. And then she finally had a dream the other night, and it was, she said it wasn't even a very sexy dream, but she saw him and it was a very pleasant dream. And so I mentioned that only because I just don't see many things as, you know, like many books, for example, as good or bad, right? Christian Grey is not good or bad. He's different things to different people. And I absolutely think it's the case that just as there are going to be many people who pick this up and read it and love it, and others will be neutral about it, there are going to be some people who are disturbed by it, who don't like it. And I think for any material, if you find yourself disturbed by something and or it's just not something that interests you, you know, put it down and make note of yourself what you don't like. You might want to explore some of that on your own time at some point, you know, why you like some things and don't like others. But it's absolutely the case that I think any process of sexual exploration or erotic exploration is trying to learn what our own personal boundaries are and interests.
Okay, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Debbie Herbenick and Tracy Clark Flory, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Tracy Clark Flory, staff writer at Salon. Debbie Herbenick is a sex researcher, a research scientist, I should say. She's written several books, including most recently Sex Made Easy. We were talking about 50 Shades of Grey. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including email, Facebook, Twitter, archives, podcasts, and much more. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Dennis Devine. I'm Artie Moscoane. We're going to close things out with Doc Watson and one of his signature songs. Doc Watson died yesterday at the age of 89. This is Black Mountain Rag.